Thank you very much for having me. So this talk is based on these two papers along with Shira Chapman and Yaron Oz, as well as a soon to be published paper with Yaron Oz and Ovia Raviv Moshe. So the two main things I want to accomplish in this talk are, first of all, to explain how to derive the general structure of non-relativistic scale anomalies in curved space-time, depending on the symmetries of the theory and the existence of a foliation structure. And second, to develop a method to calculate the coefficients of these anomalies from flat space correlation functions using a split dimensional regularization scheme. So I will start with a brief introduction. I will then review the coupling of non-relativistic field theories to curved space-time. Then I will discuss the general structure of non-relativistic scale anomalies. Finally, I will discuss the calculation of these, the coefficients of these anomalies from split dimensional regularization. So I will consider non-relativistic field theories in D plus one dimensions, which are invariant under Lipschitz scale symmetry, which is a non-relativistic scale symmetry, where time scales differently than space. And Z is known as the dynamical critical exponent, as well as the standard time translations, and space rotations. Now, such Lipschitz field theories occur in nature in quantum critical points of condensed Messier systems, which are critical points of zero temperature phase transitions that are induced by tuning some external parameters, such as the magnetic field. They are described by an effective quantum field theory, which is Lipschitz invariant. And they are believed to be the cause of strange metal phases in certain high TC superconductors and heavy fermion compounds. Now, I will also consider Lipschitz field theories, which are invariant under the full Galilean group, which contains, in addition, the Galilean boosts, which are just the standard non-relativistic boosts, as well as a global U1 symmetry M corresponding to a conserved particle number. Note that M is a central extension of the Galilean algebra, and it's dimensionless only when Z equals to 2. Now, of course, Galilean field theories can be obtained from relativistic field theories by taking the non-relativistic limit. However, they can also be obtained from relativistic field theories in one dimension more, using a null reduction procedure. However, I will not go into much detail about that in this talk for lack of time. So two very simple examples of Lipschitz field theories are, first, the free real Lipschitz scalar in D dimensions and an even value of Z, given by this action here, where kappa is a dimensionless parameter. And the second example is the complex free Schrödinger scalar, given by this action here, which is invariant under Lipschitz scale symmetry with Z equals to 2, as well as Galilean boosts and a global U1 symmetry. So a very brief review of conformal anomalies. So in relativistic conformal field theories, the world identity that corresponds to scale invariants is for the stress energy tensor to be traceless. However, in even space-time dimensions, when the quantum field theory is defined over a curved space-time manifold, it can violate this identity. And this is known as the conformal or viol or trace anomaly. And when this happens, the expectation value of the trace of the stress energy tensor is given by this linear combination of curvature scalars of the background manifold, where ED is the Euler density of the manifold and is known as an A-type anomaly. The I's are viol invariant densities of the background manifold and are known as B-type anomalies. And the coefficients depend on the contents of the theory. Now, these terms appear when one requires the stress energy tensor to be both conserved and symmetric. And when they appear, the curved space-time action W is no longer viol invariant. And instead, its viol transformation is given by this local expression here, where A is this expression. Now, these anomalous terms also appear as contact terms in flat space correlation functions involving the trace of the stress energy tensor. And the possible structure of these anomalous terms, which is this structure here, is dictated by the West-Domino consistency condition. And the problem of finding solutions to this consistency condition can be formulated as a cohomological problem, as I will detail later. So for non-relativistic field theories, the world identity that corresponds to Lipschitz invariants is this generalized tracelessness identity. And just like in the relativistic case, this identity can be violated due to quantum anomalies. And so our goal will be to find the general structure of these anomalies and calculate their coefficients. So in relativistic field theories, coupling the theory to a curved space-time manifold is a very important tool even in studying the flat space theory. And in particular, it's very useful in order to study and calculate conformal anomalies. So it's important to understand how to do the same thing in the non-relativistic case. So given some D plus one dimensional background manifold, in order to couple a non-relativistic field theory to this manifold, we will have to define three structures over the manifold. First of all, we have to define a vector V that contains information about the direction and units of time at each point of the manifold. Second, we have to define a one-form T whose kernel corresponds to the space directions at each point of the manifold. Or alternatively, we can also use a normalized version N. And finally, we need to define a spatial metric P, which also functions as a projector on the space directions at each point. Now we can take this spatial metric P and the one form N and combine it to define a Lorentzian metric over the space-time manifold. And we are then left with just these two structures, the metric G and the one form T or N. And using this notation, raising the index of N with G just gives minus V. Now, alternatively, of course, we can also use the Wielbein formalism instead of the metric. Now, globally on the manifold, the integral curves of N define a global notion of time. However, the one form T doesn't necessarily define a global equal time slicing over the manifold. And whether it does or it doesn't depends on the Frobenius theorem that states that T induces a foliation on the manifold if and only if it satisfies this condition, that T wedge dt is zero. And when this condition is satisfied, T can be written as some function f times the gradient of some other function h, where h equals to constant defines the equal time slices it induces on the manifold. Now, it's important to note that using an ADM-like decomposition of the background metric, where one explicitly separates the time coordinates from the space coordinates, as is often used in the literature when coupling non-relativistic field theories to curved space-time, implicitly assumes the Frobenius condition is satisfied. So the question is, should the Frobenius condition be assumed? So on the one hand, it has been noted in the literature that when the Frobenius condition is violated, causality is broken in the non-relativistic curved space-time theory. This is based on Carl Theodori's theorem. However, on the other hand, the background structure I'm defining here is merely providing sources for the flat space field theory currents. And in particular, the one form T couples to the energy current of the theory. And so imposing the Frobenius condition is equivalent to not coupling sources to all possible components of the energy current. Now, in the cohomological analysis of the structures of Lipschitz anomalies, we will consider both of these options and compare them. And as we shall see, giving up the Frobenius condition will allow in some cases to have an A-type anomaly, but also introduce the possibility of having an infinite set of independent B-type anomalies. So some geometric implications of the Frobenius condition. So in the cohomological analysis, it's very convenient to decompose any tensor into components which are either tangent or normal to the space directions. And for example, we can decompose the covariant derivative of the one form N like this, where Ks, Ka, and A are all space tangent tensors. Ks is a symmetric tensor, which in the Frobenius case reduces to the extrinsic curvature of the foliation induced by N. Ka is an antisymmetric tensor that vanishes in the Frobenius case. And A is the acceleration vector associated with N. We can also define a space tangent covariant derivative as the space projection of the standard covariant derivative, And in the Frobenius case, this is just the covariant derivative on defoliation associated with the metric induced on it. And we can also take the commutation of two such space tangent derivatives over some vector V, and we get this expression here, where R tilde is yet another space tangent tensor, which in the Frobenius case is simply the intrinsic Riemann curvature of the foliation. However, generally, it does not have all of the regular symmetries of the Riemann tensor. But conveniently, we can define another tensor, R hat, using this Ka and Ks, which does have all of these symmetries, except for the second Bianchi identity. So generally, in this framework, the implication of violating the Frobenius condition is simply that Ka no longer vanishes, and various geometric identities, such as the Gauss-Kodaczy relations, are modified accordingly. Now, in the case of a field theory which is invariant under the full Galilean group, we also have an added global U1 symmetry. It corresponds to some conserved particle number current. And so when coupling the theory to a curved space-time manifold, we also have to add a background gauge field A that couples to this conserved current. And the gauge invariant data of the background structure is then encoded in the field strength tensor associated with A. Alternatively, in the electric and magnetic fields, defined like this, both of which are space tangent tensors. Now, the full Galilean symmetry in this case means that we have to consider two extra symmetries over the curved space-time manifold. So the flat space global U1 symmetry translates into U1 gauge symmetry over the manifold. And the flat space Galilean boosts translates into local Milne boosts over the curved space-time manifold, which I will detail in a moment. So the general implication of adding the Galilean symmetry to the problem is just that in the cohomological analysis, we have to restrict ourselves only to terms which are both gauge and Milne boost invariant. Now, an important note is in order here. For the purposes of this work, the structure I defined here is completely equivalent to the well-known Newton-Cartan structure, which is often used in the literature when coupling Galilean field theories to curved space-time. The only difference is the choice of a fine connection. So, as I mentioned earlier, the flat space symmetries of the theory translate into local symmetries over the curved space-time manifold. So first we have rotation invariance, which translates over the manifold to time direction preserving diffeomorphisms, which are diffeomorphisms that preserve the structure of the one form T. And when the Frobenius condition is satisfied, these are just what is known as foliation preserving diffeomorphisms, which are coordinate transformations of this form. Now, this subgroup of diffeomorphisms can be extended back to the full group of diffeomorphisms simply by having the one form T transform appropriately, as one would expect from a diffeomorphism. And when we do that, we just end up with standard diffeomorphism invariants. The second symmetry is the Lipschitz invariance, which translates over the curved space-time manifold to local anisotropic Wahl invariance, given by this transformation here, where sigma is the Wahl parameter of these transformations. And note that the dimension of the one form N under this transformation is Z, which is expected since N is the representative of the time direction. And the dimension of the gauge field A is determined from the Galilean algebra. Now, in the Galilean case, we also have Galilean boost invariance, which translates into local Milne boost invariance over the manifold, given by these transformations here, where W is a space tangent vector parameter of this transformation, which is the analog of the Galilean velocity V in flat space. And finally, of course, we have global U1 invariance that translates into the standard U1 gauge invariance. Now, given the curved space-time action, S, we can define the field theory currents as the variation of S with respect to the various background fields. So we can define the stress energy tensor either as its variation with respect to the metric, which I will call Tg, or with respect to the Willebrand, which I will call Te. We can also define J as the variation of S with respect to the one form T. And in the Galilean case, we can define the mass or particle number current as the variation of S with respect to the gauge field. Note that unlike the relativistic case, these two definitions of the stress energy tensor are not equal, but instead they are related by this relation here, which means that while Tg is symmetric, Te is not necessarily symmetric. Now, of course, these currents satisfy world identities that correspond to the symmetries I mentioned earlier. So from diffeomorphism invariants, we have the conservation of the stress energy tensor, either Tg or Te. And what these identities mean in flat space is that Tg is symmetric but not conserved, whereas Te is conserved but not symmetric. We can't have both at the same time. From anisotropic value invariants, we get this generalized stresslessness identity. And from Milne-Boost invariants, in the Galilean case, we get this identity here, which is just the famous statement that in Galilean field theories, the momentum density is equal to the particle number current. And finally, of course, from gauge invariants, we get the conservation of the particle number current. So our goal will be to find the possible anomalous corrections to this world identity, assuming the other ones are not anomalous. So this part of the talk is based on these two papers with Shira Chapin and Yaron Oz. And a general goal was to find the general form of scale anomalies as allowed by the West Domino consistency conditions in non-relativistic field theories. And both in the cases with and without Galilean boost invariants and with and without foliation structure, and compare these cases. So given the quantum effective action over curved space-time W, the anomalous world identity that corresponds to anisotropic value invariants is this one, delta W equals A, where A is some local functional of the background fields and the parameter sigma. And the West Domino consistency condition then takes this form, which is just a statement that two such anisotropic value transformations commute with each other. Now, a trivial solution for this consistency condition is a solution of the form delta G, where G is a local functional of the background fields. And such a trivial solution can always be canceled by adding an appropriate local counterterm to the effective action W. And therefore, these trivial solutions are not considered anomalies. And so what we are looking for are the non-trivial solutions to this consistency condition. And the problem of finding these non-trivial solutions can also be formulated as a cohomological problem using a BRST-like description in the following way. We first replace the parameter sigma by a Grassmannian ghost. We define the operator delta such that it becomes nilpotent. And then the West Domino consistency condition takes the form delta A equals zero. And so the solutions of this condition become the co-cycles of the operator delta, or in other words, they are delta closed. And the trivial solutions are co-boundaries of this operator, or they are delta exact. So the possible anomalies are those terms which are co-cycles but not co-boundaries, or in other words, terms that satisfy these two conditions, where both A and G are local functionals of the background field, which are also invariant under the rest of the symmetries of the theory. And so in this formulation, what we are looking for is the relative cohomology of the operator delta with respect to TPDs, to Milne boosts, and to gauge transformations. Now, the first step in solving this problem is to find all possible scalars with a specific Lipschitz dimension. And one can show that all such scalars can be built from a list of basic space tangent tensors written here. Each of them has three values associated with it, nt, ns, and n epsilon, such that its Lipschitz dimension is z, nt plus ns, and its parity is n epsilon. Now, in the Frobenius case, NT and NS are simply the total number of time or space derivatives in the, each of these expressions, respectively. However, generally, they do not have this interpretation, but in any case, their sum, which I will denote by ND, is always the total number of derivatives in the expression. Note that the NT value of KA is negative, which is going to be important to understand the consequences of the Frobenius condition on this problem. So a convenient property of the cohomological problem in this case is that it can be solved for each of these NT, NS, and N epsilon sectors separately, because these sectors don't mix under anisotropic Val transformations. So given some values of D and Z, we can first find all possible sectors corresponding to these values, which are the sectors that satisfy these two conditions. And we can then solve the cohomological problem separately for each of these sectors. The first condition just means that the total number of the total Lipschitz dimension is D plus Z. And the second just means that the total number of indices is even, so they can all be contracted. Now, from these conditions, it's already apparent that when the Frobenius condition is not satisfied and Z is at least 2, there is an infinite number of solutions to these conditions. Therefore, there is an infinite number of sectors, and it's at least theoretically possible to have an infinite number of independent anomalies. And as we shall see, this is indeed what happens. So for the result, I will focus on the case of 2 plus 1 dimensions with Z equals to 2. And we consider 4 subcases to this case, both with and without the Frobenius condition and with and without Galilean boost invariants. And before I begin, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, it's convenient to make these extra geometric definitions using the Levi-Civita tensor. So the first case is the case with Frobenius and Galilean boost invariants. In this case contains these 6 sectors. However, the sectors with time derivatives turn out to contain no expressions which are both Milne boost and gauge invariant. Conversely, the purely spatial sectors, it turns out that all scalars in these sectors are automatically boost invariant. And therefore, the sectors are identical to the same sectors in the next case, which is the case with no Galilean boost invariants. And so we are left with, in the end, with one possible anomaly given by this expression here, which is a B-type anomaly in the four derivative sector. Now, the second case is the case with Frobenius and no Galilean boost invariants. And this case, again, contains these 6 sectors. And we found 2 possible anomalies in these sectors, one in the two derivative sector and one in the four derivative sector, given by these expressions, both of which are B-type anomalies. So the third and perhaps most interesting case is the case without Frobenius and with Galilean boost invariants. And as I mentioned earlier, this case contains an infinite number of sectors, and we perform full analysis over only for the sectors with less than 4 derivatives and the parity even sector with 4 derivatives. So these 5 sectors. An important property of this subcase is that it can be derived from a null reduction of a 3 plus 1 dimensional Lorentzian manifold with a compact null isometry. However, we did not use this property in this analysis. We performed it directly in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So once again, it turns out that there are no boost invariant expressions in the sectors with less than 4 derivatives. And this is actually expected from the null reduction procedure I mentioned, because in the 3 plus 1 dimensional manifold, there are no dimension 4 scalars with less than 4 derivatives. And in the 4 derivative sector, it turns out that the cohomology mirrors the standard relativistic Weyl cohomology in 3 plus 1 dimensions exactly. And this is also expected from the null reduction procedure, since this sector corresponds to those scalars in the 3 plus 1 dimensional manifold, which are built only from the background curvature of the manifold, which are the same scalars involved in the standard relativistic Weyl cohomology in 3+1 dimensions. And so we expect to find in this sector one A-type anomaly and one B-type anomaly, just like in the standard relativistic case in 3+1 dimensions. And this is indeed what we get. So the first messy expression here is the A-type anomaly that corresponds to the Euler density in the 3+1 dimensional manifold. And the second one is the B-type anomaly that corresponds to the Weyl tensor squared in the 3+1 dimensional manifold. Now it's instructive to see what happens to these expressions when we take Ka to zero. So the B-type anomaly here reduces to the same B-type anomaly we saw in the Frobenius case, obviously. But the A-type anomaly does not vanish, but instead it reduces to an expression that becomes trivial and can be removed by this counter term. Now for the sectors with more than four derivatives, we did not perform full analysis, but we can easily show that they contain an infinite set of B-type anomalies. Since Ka in this case is invariant both under anisotropic Weyl, gauge, and Mildebus transformations, if we can take this B-type anomaly here and multiply it by some power of Ka to obtain another independent B-type anomaly with higher and higher order of derivatives. So it's apparent that these sectors contain an infinite set of independent B-type anomalies. Of course, they can also contain other anomalies as well. The fourth and last case is the case without Frobenius and with no Galilean boost invariants. And once again, there is an infinite number of sectors in this case. And once again, we performed full analysis only for these five sectors, the ones with less than four derivatives and the parity even sector with four derivatives. And we found these six B-type anomalies in these sectors. And once again, we can take any one of these B-type anomalies and multiply it by some power of Ka to obtain an infinite set of B-type anomalies. So to conclude this part, when coupling non-relativistic field theories to a curved space-time manifold, the existence of a foliation structure can be important even for studying flat space quantities. And in the case of 2+1 dimensions with z equals to 2, we saw that it changed the possible forms of Lipschitz anomalies considerably. And we saw that an A-type anomaly is possible in this case only if we both impose Galilean boost invariants and give up the foliation structure of space-time. But when we do that, we also introduce the possibility of having an infinite set of B-type anomalies.
Do you have a comment on that? The fact that you have a non-trivial cohomology class doesn't really imply that you have an anomaly. It could be that the anomaly vanishes for all theories. There are examples of the ways we're consistent.
Yes, that's true. This is just what I mean here by anomalies is just from the perspective of the cohomological analysis.
Yeah, but not.
Yes, there could be some physical reason why they cannot be. So this part of the talk is based on the soon-to-be-published work with Yaron Oz and Aviara Viv-Moshe. And our general goal was to understand the structure of word identities of flat space correlation functions in Lipschitz field theories, and to develop a method to calculate the coefficients of Lipschitz anomalies from these correlation functions using a split-dimensional regularization scheme. So in the past, the coefficients of Lipschitz anomalies have been calculated using heat kernel methods and zeta function regularization. However, they can also be computed directly from flat space correlation functions of the stress energy tensor. So suppose we define these correlation functions as the variation of the effective action with respect to the Willebrand. Then starting from the curved space-time anomalous word identity for anisotropic Weyl invariants, which is this one, where d mu nu is the Lipschitz trace operator. If we take the variations of this word identity with respect to the Willebrand, we can derive word identities for the flat space correlation functions. And for example, for the 2 and 3 point functions, we get these word identities here. And so by calculating the renormalized correlation functions, plugging them into these word identities, and then comparing them to the variations of the cohomological cocycles we saw in the last part of the talk with respect to the Vilbans, we can extract the coefficients both for the trivial terms and the anomalies. Note that unlike the relativistic case, in order to use this method to extract the coefficients for all possible anomalies, we would have to calculate all endpoint functions of the stress energy tensor, since, as I mentioned earlier, there may be an infinite number of anomalies with higher and higher order of the background fields. Now, just like the relativistic case, the correlation function of the stress energy tensor have to be renormalized. And for that end, we use a split dimensional regularization scheme defined as follows. We first define the theory in dt time dimensions and ds space dimensions, such that it's invariant both under time rotations and space rotations. We then calculate some correlation function I as a function of these dimensions, dt and ds, and analytically continue these dimensions to 1 minus epsilon t time dimensions and d minus epsilon s space dimensions. Then to one loop order, the correlation function I takes this form, where epsilon Lifshitz is z epsilon t plus epsilon s, and f is some regular function of the epsilons. And in order to renormalize this expression, we first have to choose some parameter epsilon tilde to keep fixed as we take the limit of the epsilons going to zero. And once we did that, we can rewrite I as a function of epsilon Lifshitz and epsilon tilde. And by expanding in epsilon Lifshitz, we can separate the pole part from the regular part of I. And the regular part of I will then become the renormalized correlation function. And the pole part represents a local counter term. Now, it's important to note that this renormalization procedure depends on the choice of epsilon tilde. So changing the choice of epsilon tilde, will change our renormalized correlation function by a local term proportional to alpha, where alpha is some parameter that corresponds to the choice of epsilon tilde. Now, in the Lifshitz case, it's generally more difficult to fully evaluate Feynman diagrams than in the relativistic case, since the denominators of the propagators are polynomials of degree 2z instead of 2. However, luckily, in some cases, in order to calculate the anomalous contribution to the world identities, we only need to know the epsilon Lifshitz pole, or the divergent part of the correlation functions. So suppose the world identity that corresponds to Lifshitz invariance is given by some linear operator T acting on a set of correlation functions. Then as long as the split dimensional regularization procedure which I described doesn't explicitly break Lifshitz invariance of the theory, we expect the unrenormalized correlation functions to satisfy these world identities exactly. And so the anomaly will then come purely from the counterterm part. So if we can just calculate this counterterm part, plug it back into the world identities, and take the limits of the epsilons going to zero, we can get the anomalous contribution to the world identity. However, note that if we change the choice of regularization epsilon tilde, this anomalous contribution A will change by a trivial term proportional to the alpha I mentioned earlier. This is a trivial term since it's given by T acting on some local expression. So, of course, this is expected since we only expect the coefficients of trivial terms to be dependent on the regularization scheme and therefore on alpha. Now, the epsilon Lifshitz pole of the Feynman diagrams can be easily computed without fully evaluating these diagrams by expanding the integrand of the diagram in powers of the external momenta. And the result is a polynomial in the external momenta with coefficients which are just solvable integrals of well-known form that depend only on the loop momentum of the diagram. And we can then use this procedure to extract the pole part of the diagram without actually fully evaluating it, then plugging it back into the world identity, taking the limit of the epsilon is going to zero, and get the anomalous contribution, and from there extract the coefficients, both for the anomalies and the trivial terms. So taken as an example, the case of a free z equals to 2 scalar in 2 plus 1 dimensions, given by this action here. So in order to perform split-dimensional regularization, we first have to couple this theory to a curved space-time manifold with dt time directions and ds space directions. And this coupling has to be done in a way which is both anisotropic val invariant and non-singular, as we take the number of time dimensions to 1. And this is not a completely trivial task, but it's possible, and in fact there is more than one way to do it. And we chose to use this curved space-time action here, where the NIs are a set of orthonormal one-forms that correspond to the dt time directions. And the various background expressions here are defined similarly to how they are defined in the case of one time dimension. And this action here is indeed invariant both under diffeomorphisms, under anisotropic val transformations, and also under local rotations of the time direction. So from this curved space-time action, we can of course derive the flat space stress energy tensor in general number of space and time dimensions. And we can then consider the Feynman diagrams that contribute to the 2 and 3 point functions of these of this stress energy tensor, which are these ones. And then by following the procedure I described earlier, we can extract the divergent parts of these diagrams and finally the coefficients for the anomalies and the trivial terms. So we performed this computation for the 2 and 3 point functions of the stress energy tensor. And of course, because we didn't perform it for any higher point functions, we can only extract the coefficients for terms which are at most second order in the background fields. And since this computation involves thousands of monomial terms, we use the Mathematica script to perform it. And our results are indeed consistent with previous calculations that people did using the heat kernel method. And as expected, only coefficients of trivial terms depend on the choice of regularization alpha. So for the two derivative sector, we saw that there is this one anomaly, and in this case it has this coefficient, which is the same coefficient that people got from the heat kernel method. And there is also a trivial term with this coefficient that depends on alpha. Now for the four derivative sector, there are three independent anomalies up to second order in the background fields. All of them have vanishing coefficients, which is also consistent with previous results. And there are also 9 independent trivial terms up to this order, all of which have coefficients which are proportional to this alpha. And interestingly, some of the trivial terms with non-vanishing coefficients are ones that violate the Frobenius condition. So for example, this trivial term here, which vanishes in the Frobenius case, has a non-vanishing coefficient. And therefore, for alpha different than zero, we would have to violate the Frobenius condition in order to cancel it using a counter term. Now, for theories that include the Lipschitz scalar with z equals to d, an interesting ambiguity seems to occur with the coefficients of these anomalies. So in these cases, the scalar field is dimensionless. And suppose, for example, that A is some B-type anomaly density of the theory, which is at least second order in the background fields. Then we can always add to the curved space-time action a term of this form without breaking its anisotropic val invariance. And such a term was first suggested by Griffin Orava and Melby Thompson in their paper from 2012. Now, neither the flat space action nor the flat space currents of the theory change as a result of this addition. However, interestingly enough, the anomaly coefficient of A does change by beta times C, where beta is this coefficient, and C is a constant derived from this anomalous world identity. So unlike the relativistic field theory, specifying the flat space action and the flat space currents of the theory is not enough to determine the consistent anomaly coefficients. One would have to specify the full curved space-time action. And this type of ambiguity doesn't occur in the relativistic case, since in two-dimensional theories where the scalar is dimensionless, there are no B-type anomalies. In other words, there are no valid variants of the background manifold. Now, note, however, that the correlation function of these operators phi to the n diverge logarithmically in the infinite volume limit. And therefore, for field theories that have no built-in IR cutoff, this ambiguity doesn't actually occur because this operator phi to the n is not really a legitimate operator in the theory.
Sorry, in this Lipschitz theory, is this truth of dimension consistent with unitarity?
Again?
So can you go back?
Yes.
So, is five-ring dimensionless consistent with unitarity?
What is consistent?
Five-ring dimensionless.
It wouldn't be
in the relativistic world.
Well, it's a good question. I didn't look into it, but
scale plus minus alone give you constraints of unitarity, the dimensions of things.
Yes, but these are not the standard scale transformation
for.
Yes, but perhaps I didn't look into it, so I can't tell for sure if that's true. But I can tell you that people have proposed such additions. So, well, at least in the free 2+1 dimensional theory that we studied earlier, that for the results I cited earlier, I mean the phi is dimensionless and there is no, I mean we didn't see any problems with it, but.
I say that you can also do similar things in the relativistic case, give phi dimensions to phi, but then the theory can be conformal or whatever, but then it's not unitary. So you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is something for the future, I guess. The results I cited earlier are for the minimal coupling case, so without any such additions. In conclusion, a split-dimensional regularization method was used to calculate the Lipschitz anomaly coefficients in the free scalar case. And some of the trivial terms we found with non-vanishing coefficients are ones that violate the Frobenius condition. And in the Z equal to D scalar case, the relation between the flat space correlation functions of the stress energy tensor and the consistent anomaly coefficients is somewhat ambiguous, at least in some cases. So several questions follow from this work. First of all, regarding the Frobenius condition, can we consistently define a quantum field theory over a curved space-time manifold that violates this condition? And if not, then what are the implications on the calculation of flat space quantities? And also, can we find examples of theories with non-vanishing coefficients for anomalies that violate this condition? A second question is whether we can find a general structure for Lipschitz anomalies for a general value of D and general value of Z, both with and without the Galilean boost invariance, as people have been able to do in the relativistic case. Third interesting direction is trying to use the split-dimensional regularization method to calculate the coefficients of Lipschitz anomalies for other type of Lipschitz or Galilean field theories. The fourth question is whether the coefficient of the A-type anomaly we saw in the boost invariant case has any interesting properties along argflows, and whether it can perhaps lead to an A theorem for Galilean theories, as it has in the relativistic case. The fifth question is whether there are any interesting implications for the ambiguity I mentioned in the Z equal to D scalar case. And finally, there's the question of whether Galilean field theories, which are Lipschitz invariant, are necessarily invariant under the full Schrödinger group, which is the analog of the conformal group in the relativistic case. So, thank you.
I didn't understand. Does your result imply that this Frobenius is not consistent with quantum corrections or not? I mean, because you show that even if you start with something that has Frobenius, then you generate some counterterms that are
and you
need to cancel them by adding something that violates Frobenius. So
it's not that it's not consistent. It's just that if you assume the Frobenius condition, that you limit the sources you couple to your field theory currents arbitrarily. So there will be some things that you won't be able to see from that. So in the case of anomalies, there will be anomalies you wouldn't see from this curved space-time description, but when you do the calculation in flat space, you do get these structures. So if all you are interested in is studying the flat space theory and you are using this curved space-time background just as sources you couple to various currents, then in my opinion, at least, or in my interpretation, it wouldn't be correct to assume the Frobenius condition. However, if you actually are interested in a quantum field theory defined over a curved space-time manifold, then this is another question, because not assuming the Frobenius condition may be completely ill-defined.
This fact that in some cases you generated these terms does not have any implications? Doesn't it mean that you somehow violate the Frobenius condition?
No? Well, the flat space theory doesn't have... I mean, the flat space theory always satisfies the Frobenius condition, right? Because it has equal time slices. So the only question is whether you violate it in the curved space-time, but if your curved space-time is merely providing sources for flat space, then it doesn't matter. No.
What are some examples of interacting Lipschitz invariant series?
Well, obviously, classically, it's quite easy to make such theories. Quantum mechanically, it's actually an interesting question. I'm not sure if anyone actually managed to construct such a theory which is actually Lipschitz invariant, which is interacting. I mean, I'm not familiar anyway.
Because of the actual expansion.
Yes, that's true.
Like this fermions at unitarity.
Yes, but is that theory?
That theory is
I don't think it's Lipschitz invariant. I think it just has a fixed point. No.
Like Schrödinger invariant.
Again.
Schrödinger invariant.
But in a specific fixed point or general, you mean? Does it have a beta function which vanishes?
Yes.
Okay. So.
What about gravitational anomalies?
That's also a good question. We did not study it in this work, but that's also, of course, a possible future direction to study the equivalent of gravitational anomalies.
Tuft anomalies?
Yes, also. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there were some attempts, but I'm not even sure that they are correct, these attempts, so we can discuss later more about that. But
thank you.